Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, it's Lauren Smith here, producer of The Brendan O'Neill Show. Before we get into this week's episode with Greg Lukianoff, I just wanted to give you a heads up about our sponsor, The Monk Debates. The Monk Debates are where the world's leading figures and thinkers go to discuss the big, hot-button issues of our time. If you're listening to this podcast, then these intellectual sparring matches are probably right up your street. So you won't want to miss the next Monk Debate on anti-Zionism. On the 17th of June, commentator Douglas Murray, broadcaster Mehdi Hassan, and others will be discussing whether anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. The debate will take place in person in downtown Toronto, Canada, but don't worry if you can't make the trip. Supporters of the Monk Debates can watch the live stream for free. You can become a supporter for just $9.99 Canadian dollars a month. That's just under £6 for our UK listeners. As a supporter, you'll get early access to tickets and priority seating for events like the upcoming anti-Zionism debate, plus complimentary live streaming of the event if you can't make it in person. Supporters can also watch 15 years worth of past debates, dialogues, and podcasts from the Monk Debates archives. You can watch David Frum and Steve Bannon debate the future of populism from 2018, or watch the late Christopher Hitchens debate Tony Blair on whether or not religion is a force for good. Whatever interests you, there's almost certainly a Monk Debate about it. And for a limited time only, Monk Debates are offering a 10% discount on supporter membership for listeners to this podcast. Just use the code SPIKED10, that's SPIKED10, at checkout to get 10% off. So to find out more and to claim your supporter discount, go to monkdebates.com. That's MUNKdebates.com. And don't forget to use the discount code SPIKED10 to get 10% off. That's code SPIKED10 at checkout at monkdebates.com. And now on with the show.
It's always essential to know what people really think. That's not even if they have horrible points of view. It's especially true if the people you're talking about have horrible points of view. Because knowing that someone has, like, legit, you know, eugenic ideas of racial superiority, that's incredibly important information. You're not safer from the world for knowing less about it. Censorship doesn't actually change people's opinions. It encourages them to talk to people they already agree with. All you're trying to avoid is the unpleasantness of knowing what people really think. You're gonna have to get over that.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Greg Lukianoff. Greg, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Brendan.
Always good to have you on. I feel like it's been too long. So there's no doubt a lot for us to catch up on, especially in relation to the area of freedom of speech. That is what you are known for, first in your role as president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, otherwise known as FIRE, which does excellent work on campuses in the United States in terms of defending freedom of thought and freedom of speech. And of course, in relation to all the books that you've been writing on this issue for quite some time, the most recent of which is The Canceling of the American Mind. Cancel culture undermines trust and threatens us all, but there is a solution. So that's the kind of stuff I want to talk to you about. And I guess I want to kick off by asking you how things are going on this front, because I try to keep an eye on the cancel culture question as much as possible. It's the bread and butter of your working life, so you know it better than most people. But I think it's fair to say that it isn't on the front pages of the papers in the way that it might have been 5 years ago or 10 years ago, when there was a story every other week about some crazy thing happening on an American campus or a British campus. No doubt because there are so many big issues going on in the world and there's lots that people are talking about and so on. So I just wanted to ask you, how do things stand on the cancel culture front, especially on campuses? Is it still really bad? Is it getting better? How do you see things?
I think it's still really bad. You know, when I was working on Canceling of the American Mind, which was my follow-up to my book with Jonathan Haidt, Coddling of the American Mind, that just came out in October of last year, in the process of writing and researching it with my incredible co-author, 23-year-old Wunderkind, Ricky Schlott, I found it just very depressing, because even though I've been FIRE turns 25 this year, or has turned 25 this year, I've been there for 23 of those years. Things started getting worse for free speech, both on and off campus around 2014, a point that we make both in Canceling and in Coddling. And then it really accelerated after 2017 with a giant spike around 2020 when everybody seemed to have just lost their minds ideologically. But in the course of writing it, for me to look at the research and be like, oh, wow, this is even worse than I thought, you know, was pretty sobering. So the book came out on October 17th. So obviously, you know, 10 days after the October 7th attacks, we didn't see that coming, of course. But I would say one good thing that came out of the October 7th attacks was that I very rarely run into anyone anymore who thinks that there's not a problem on campus. I mean, when I did Bill Maher's show back in December, he said, it's like, that's the one good thing that happened about it, is that everybody knows that there's an ideological problem on campus. And whereas you were saying that you're not seeing as much about campuses, you know, in the news, maybe in Britain, in the U.S., it's been nonstop, particularly because of the pro-Palestinian protests we've seen on campus over the last several months. And normally, you know, my job is to be like, you can't do that because that's protected speech. You can't do that because that's protected speech. A lot of what we've seen on campus for the last, you know, honestly, like 6 months in particular, but also, you know, 2 years is, that's protected. That's protected. That's definitely not protected. That's actually anti-free speech right there. That's actually a shout down. That's actually someone chasing someone off campus when they're trying to speak. They should actually be probably expelled for that, because in this case, the students are actually threats to freedom of speech on campus. So I would say that and this might, you know, come as a bit of a surprise. Deplatforming, which we define as, you know, getting someone disinvited, but also shouting someone down or preventing an event from being able to go on. 2023 was the worst year we'd ever seen for that, according to, you know, our in-depth research. And 2024 is going to blow that out of the water. And it's overwhelmingly student groups, pro-Palestinian student groups, coming and shouting down speakers, sometimes pro-Israel speakers, but oftentimes ones that had nothing to do, you know, with the conflict, including one case, I can't remember what school, but they targeted a professor who was there to talk about black holes, which is just like, I'd go to that in a heartbeat. But as best I can tell, because he was quote unquote Zionist, by which they, in this case, seem to mean Jewish. So it's been a really ugly time over the past couple of years, and particularly in the past year. But I'm hoping that people are waking up to the idea that this is serious. When you have a place that's this biased and this ideological, it harms the production of ideas. It makes it a situation where the public isn't stupid, and they look at higher ed and they're like, seems like they're so biased that we should really only trust them when they come out with something that's counter-narrative. You're destroying people's trust in the expert class, and that's dangerous for democracies. And while I see a little move to fix things around the edges, I'm not confident they really will.
Okay, let's jump straight into the post-7th of October moment. You're absolutely right. That has been a huge campus story. And it has been here as well, in fact. Not only because we've had lots of reports about what's happening in America, in Colombia and elsewhere, but also because we've had similar encampments on British campuses too. They haven't quite kicked off as violently or as crazily as some of the American ones, but they have been there and they have been quite odd at times as well. So that has definitely been the big campus story in recent months. And I want to ask you what you think about it generally before we dig down into some of the specifics of it and how it touches on the arguments you make in your most recent book as well. Because it is a bit of a contradictory process, I feel, because on the one hand, you have these students, some of whom are presenting their protests almost as anti-safe space. So I've seen people explicitly making the argument, some of these campers, I've seen them explicitly say, listen, Jewish kids or Zionist kids or Zionist speakers, however you want to refer to them, what they're saying to them is, you just have to put up with this. It might hurt your feelings. You might be offended because we're saying F Israel or whatever else they're saying, but that's life. You have to put up with it. Two things struck me about that. The first is, well, now all of a sudden, you activists think it's fine to hurt people's feelings, which is not what you've been saying for the past 5 or 10 years. So that's a bit of a turnaround. And one might see it as a bit of a prejudiced turnaround because it only applies to certain social groups and not others. But then the other side of it, which is what makes it contradictory and sometimes difficult to get a handle on it, is precisely the point you make, which is that even though these protests seem boisterous and argumentative and arrogant, and they're saying to people, just suck it up, this is our right to protest, at the same time, they are shutting down speakers, they are shrinking the sphere for reasonable debate. So how do you see it in the round? Do you see this as a challenge to the safe space, or as a further formulation of it in a new way?
I mean, you know, we talk about this in Canceling of the American Mind, and we talk about cancel culture as basically the uptick of trying to get people's careers ruined, get them expelled, fired, deplatformed, et cetera, for speech that would be considered protected for, say, like a public employee under the First Amendment in the United States. But we also try to get people to understand cancel culture as part of a rhetorical strategy to win arguments without actually persuading anybody, to more or less scare your opponent out of saying what they really think. And in that sense, cancel culture was a huge success, particularly what you watched in 2020, people saying things that might be the slightest bit anti-woke or maybe mildly critical of the organization Black Lives Matter. And next thing you know, their careers are in jeopardy when it actually turns out there was huge corruption for corporate BLM. And the tactic, the way of thinking of cancel culture as winning arguments without winning arguments, has always relied on double standards. So it's not a big shock to me that essentially these people who had been at least allied with, but oftentimes the very same people who are arguing, you know, fat phobia is a form of violence and that not using someone's preferred pronouns, even if they're Z or Zay, is violence, are then saying things that sound an awful lot of like, kill all the Jews in Israel, is something you just have to put up with. So the reason why I don't really see that as a turning point among the activist class at campus is that they already had assumed this perfect rhetorical fortress. They'd always assumed that there was going to be some rhetorical rationalization to justify whatever the hell they want. And we're always right. You're always wrong. So I think that the rest of us noticing it, though, gives us the opportunity to be like, okay, we're calling bullshit on you actually claiming to be exquisitely sensitive young people. You're actually can be quite cruel and dismissive. Now, meanwhile, you know, FIRE has been defending pro-Palestinian student protests, pro-Palestinian professors. Sometimes when they say things are, you know, even raise my hair a little bit, but nonetheless, it is protected speech and should be in the United States. But we've also seen the pro-Palestinian student groups go out and like I mentioned before, shout down speakers in record numbers. And schools are being given an opportunity here that essentially, like when you see like at Berkeley, that students got together, you know, they did us the favor from an evidentiary standpoint of having all caps shut it down and then swarmed a talk by an Israeli Defense Force speaker so that they had to run for it. They had to evacuate the place where he was trying to speak. You know, they broke windows and stormed in and all this kind of sort of fascist behavior, which, of course, they think everyone else is a fascist. Then that's a situation where, no, the ones who engage in violence should be expelled. If your response on campus is violence in response to speech, you have no place on a campus. And one of the reasons why a lot of schools aren't taking advantage of this is, one, they're afraid of the activists, but they've gotten so used to, you know, there are special rules for the activists that at least some set of administrators feel sympathetic towards. And those rules apply to nobody else. So, you know, this whole thing has been set up on a back of gross double standards. And the situation for free speech, particularly when it comes to anything on Israel-Palestine, has just gotten way, way worse. I mean, you have to be a very brave person to come to campus and tout anything other than the pro-Palestinian line at this point, at least a lot of these schools. There are some schools that are not as political, particularly like big state schools, for example. But you want to try that at Columbia? Good luck.
That's a very useful way of putting it, actually, because while it can appear on the surface, and lots of people are comparing it to student uprisings in the 1960s, the Vietnam ones, but also before that, of course, the free speech uprisings in the early 1960s, actually the consequences are very different because it is an unforgiving climate for anyone who doesn't hold the exact same views as these students on the Israel question, the Gaza question. And it can also be an unforgiving climate for Jewish kids. It was very interesting to hear you say the word fascist there, because I'm always incredibly reluctant to use the word fascist, but it has been coming to my mind quite a lot over the past few months.
If you believe in the efficacy of violence, if you believe that all power should be centralized, if you have very condemning and oversimplified ideas about race, it's kind of like, well, what am I supposed to call you then?
And if you're forming a line of people and preventing Jewish students from going on campus, I mean, that's going to ring alarm bells for a lot of people.
And that's something that I've been accused of by a pro-Palestinian journalist in the United States of succumbing to a psyop, a psychological operation, I guess, by the Mossad or something like that, about because I think that there's a serious anti-Semitism problem on campus. But what this allegation misses, and I'm not Jewish, by the way, is that I've been saying this for 10 years. It was when I went to the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement at Berkeley. I'd written an article being critical of the dean of Berkeley and the Wall Street Journal. So they invited me out to be on some panels about the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement. And, you know, I definitely was someone who would say, it's like, well, you know, these people they're highly critical of Israel, but they're not anti-Semitic. And hanging out with this group, I'm like, okay, these are people who are highly critical of Israel and anti-Semitic. If you're engaging in gross stereotypes of what Jewish people are like, and you just assume that they are all powerful and part of some big conspiracy, I don't care if you're going to label that Zionist. Like, that's anti-Semitic. So I never apologize for saying that I do think anti-Semitism is a real problem on campus. That being said, FIRE has taken a lot of flack from some of our Jewish supporters because we oppose the American Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. Now, and I want to explain why we do. There's something called the International Holocaust Remembrance Act definition of anti-Semitism. This is written by a professor at Bard College named Ken Stern. We love him. He loves us. He's a big fan of Coddling the American Mind and FIRE. And he wrote this definition with his kind of sociologist hat on. When you're academically thinking about what anti-Semitism is, and he gave some examples in the definition, including, you know, statements like Israel's an apartheid state or Israel's acting like Nazis, all of these things that are opinions. That are protected speech in the United States. So he was very adamant, like, no, this is an academic definition. This should not have force of law. And so when they added the IHRA definition to the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, it led me, you know, to oppose something that if you just framed it as, yeah, actually Jewish students should get the same protection as black students do, we'd have literally no issue with it. We'd be kind of like, yeah, that's fine. When it comes to harassment is a pattern of severe, persistent behavior that singles people out. It's not even considered to be an exception to speech. It's considered to be, you know, not speech at all because it's a pattern of behavior. But by having that definition in there that includes actual opinions about Israel, it's kind of like, sorry, we have to oppose that. So right now, you know, because Fire is so consistent, we are getting a lot of praise from people on both sides of the political fence for being the real deal and the actual arbiters on this stuff. But we are taking a lot of flack both from the right and the left on things like, you know, admitting that anti-Semitism is real, but also opposing the Anti-Semitism Act. And why do we do this? Because we want to be the people who are always honest with the public and call balls and strikes fairly.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to let you know about our next online event. On Wednesday, the 26th of June at 8 p.m., I'll be sitting down with Melanie Phillips, the brilliant broadcaster and Times columnist. Melanie and I will be live and in conversation via Zoom talking about why Israel must win the war against Hamas, the grim rise of anti-Semitism, and the crisis of the West. We'll also be taking questions from you, the audience. This is a free event exclusive to Spiked supporters, our online donor community. If you're already a Spiked supporter, you can sign up for your ticket now on our online donor hub. And if you're not already a Spiked supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. For as little as £5 a month, you can get your ticket to this event. Plus, you'll enjoy loads of other exclusive perks like ad-free reading, access to our comments section, and access to many more live events like this one. To become a Spiked supporter, go to spiked-online.com/supporters. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. And I'll see you there on Wednesday, the 26th of June at 8 p.m. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the university presidents who landed themselves in a lot of hot water during that congressional hearing. I'm so keen to hear your thoughts on this. I've heard some of them already, but I want to dig down a bit more. Claudine Gay is the best known. She was the president of Harvard. There was MIT and Penn presidents were there as well. They didn't give a particularly good account of themselves, I felt. And it hinged on the question of whether students should be able to call for an intifada, which was interpreted by some of the people there as calling for a genocide of the Jews. Now, there's a whole discussion to be had about what the word intifada means to begin with. But there is the broader question of students having the freedom of speech to call for a genocide of the Jews. And this is where it gets really interesting, because I found myself feeling a combination of contempt and also pity for someone like Claudine Gay, because on the one hand, I just thought to myself, there is such a staggering level of hypocrisy in these presidents of universities where all sorts of speech has been clamped down on for a long time, including by people like Claudine Gay, who was, you know, pretty much a fan of cancel culture in some instances.
Who was behind the whole persecution of Roland Fryer, didn't stand up for Ronald Sullivan, like, or Carol Hooven. You know, like, Harvard earned its last place on our campus free speech ranking. I mean, dead last out of 248 schools. They had that coming, and that was before October 7th. Basically, by the time they went into that hearing, it was kind of too late, because nobody could take them seriously when they were suddenly trying to pretend. There were three people like who went to those hearings. The president of MIT. MIT is not great, but it's not that bad. But then the other two are Harvard and Penn, which are literally the two dead last schools on our campus free speech ranking, which includes the largest survey of student opinion ever done, the four largest databases of professor cancellations, student cancellations, deplatforming, et cetera. And when we worked it all together, Harvard actually got the first ever negative score. So they're invited to this testimony to see how they're handling the reaction after October 7th. And they try to paint themselves as being purists on freedom of speech. And it's like, really? Tell that to Carol Hooven, tell that to Ronald Sullivan, tell that to Amy Wax. So nobody believed them. I have a little bit of sympathy for the fact that Stefanik you know, seem to really want to paint them into a corner for having to clamp down on even protected speech. Because yes, like, can a situation which you're actually calling for genocide, like in an environment where it's actually going to happen, are there scenarios in which that is not protected speech? Sure. But when you get back to what's largely happening on campus, which is a bunch of activists shouting intifada who in some cases genuinely believe that they're talking about it's just resistance, and then shouting from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. You know, if you get people to take a deep breath, you're like, no, well, obviously the words intifada and from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free are protected. Can they be part of a pattern of discriminatory behavior? Which was the argument that they made about context. So they didn't say it well. They didn't sound very erudite when they explained it. But yeah, to be a threat, it has to be more than just a statement. There has to be context that makes it actually put a reasonable person in fear of bodily harm or death. To be harassment, it has to be targeted, it has to be severe or pervasive, etc. Now, one thing I want to be really clear here about is, have students crossed that line over the last 6 months on campus? You bet they have. And I mean, and beyond that, even further, I've seen actual assault at a higher level than I'm used to seeing on campus in an entire year. Like I said, you have actual shoutdowns, you have discriminatory harassment happening in some of these cases, you have actual threats and intimidation. But I do think that the university presidents were put in a somewhat difficult position. I don't have that much sympathy for them, because they were such hypocrites about this for such a long time. And then when it came out that Claudine Gay had engaged in a pattern of really serious plagiarism, that watching like the New York Times and these other publications trying to be like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. It's like, are you insane? Your total publication record is like 15 or something like that. And something like, you know, 60% of them had large chunks of plagiarized material in them. It's like, no, that's insanely bad. And meanwhile, Larry Summers is on our advisory council at FIRE. And I've done speeches with Larry Summers. And I made the mistake of reading his CV once before one of these talks and being like, oh my God, how on earth do you publish this much stuff? I think he was like one of the youngest professors in the history of Harvard. You know, incredibly impressive. And then to find that the person who's the president of Harvard has 14 articles earned throughout her entire career, it's a good year for a lot of top scholars, you know? So I had some sympathy, but I lost that entirely for what's her name from Penn, because she immediately, after not doing very well in the hearings and not coming off very sympathetically, she changed her opinion and said, actually, we're going to get rid of our attachment to constitutional standards at Penn. We're like, okay, we're enemies because you were disingenuous at first. You were showing double standards, and now you're actually saying we're not even going to maintain, you know, a good definition of harassment discrimination. We're glad that she left. And we actually thought the alumni proposal for a new vision going forward at Penn was really strong. We were on record saying that if Claudine Gay steps down just in the face of this treatment, though, this would be probably a bad sign. This would probably indicate that university presidents should clamp down more on protected speech if it's directed at Jewish students. And so if it had just been the hearing, we would have been somewhat uncomfortable with her being ushered off, given she just started. She was actually making some good moves towards academic freedom, particularly in response to their record terrible on the FIRE survey. But then when it came out about this pattern of behavior of plagiarism, it's like, okay, well, we can't help you with that, man.
I couldn't agree more with that. And one thing I wanted to put to you is that it's very clear in terms of the double standards and the hypocrisy, it's almost like a racial double standard, which is always a bad thing. All double standards are bad, but especially when there seems to be a racial component, because it does seem very clear that Jewish students in particular do not enjoy access to the so-called safe space. They don't have the same protections of political correctness as other students do. But at the same time, what I would say to Jewish students, and I have said it, is you don't want to be in the safe space. That's not a good place to be. And these are not so-called rights that you should want to have, because it's infantilizing. It's very dogmatic. It makes you believe that censorship is the only way that you can go through life without ever being hurt and wounded and so on. So the safe space is actually not a good place to be. So is it a situation where, yes, it is discriminatory that almost alone among the student body, Jews are not afforded those protections, but at the same time, those protections are things that we should probably do away with for all students?
Well, I mean, it's not quite alone. When you look at how identity is used conveniently in, again, the perfect rhetorical fortress, even Black students get their race card removed, oftentimes by affluent white students, if they have the wrong opinion. Taking people through the dance of the perfect rhetorical fortress is kind of fun, because when I showed Height what I was thinking for that chapter, Jonathan Height, my co-author on Coddling, he's like, Greg, don't use the actual demographic breakdown. I'm like, oh, no. I'm using the demographic breakdown because I want to point out like how effective this is at delegitimizing anyone you disagree with. And we point this out on the right and the left, that essentially just labeling someone as conservative or right-wing, or if you really hate them, fascist, is step number one. And of course, the right does this too, the labeling someone woke or, you know, libtard or like whatever. And it's almost treated as if it's an argument. It's particularly treated like an argument that it's on the left when it's not much more than just simple name calling. And it doesn't matter if you're a conservative or not. And we've seen this time and time again, people who by any definition, you know, might be 85th percentile to the left, it doesn't matter. As long as you can be accused, then your opinion doesn't matter anymore. Then we take readers through the, you know, are you Black? Are you gay? Are you cis? And we take them through this whole thing till you get down to, I think you end up something like 0.6 or something like that left of the population. And then we have to break it to everybody that, but guess what? None of that mattered. Because if you're in that 0.6 and you still have the wrong opinion, you're really in for it. Because then you have internalized misogyny. My female co-author is constantly being told she has internalized misogyny. Camille Foster on our board is constantly being told he has internalized racism. You can be told if you're a trans person that you have internalized transphobia. And that's why we call it perfect. You're always able to defeat it. So it's important to remember that these identities, like, they're tactical. And meanwhile, kind of like the pro-Palestinian students will point out, it's like, well, you know, like at Columbia, it's like, well, these Jewish students who agree with me, you know, like, we love them. They're great. And it's kind of like, well, no kidding, you love them. Very big of you, schmucks. So I think that there are categories of people, like, I, you know, I'm embarrassed to admit this, I'm a straight white male, and I don't feel particularly oppressed, but am I dismissed for that? Sure. I call it fascio casting, like casting a spell that makes someone fascist. I'm still, by any polling data, left of center, but, you know, I'm magically discounted. And I think that American Jews who think that they can improve the situation by being included in the list of oppressed groups are looking at a false hope. Now, one, like you said, there's a good argument they don't want to be part of that group in the first place because it's infantilizing. But two, it's going to be enforced by the same people who created this whole problem in the first place. They're going to still have the same double standards. And that's why if you're looking to repair things on campus, you have to get rid of the department. You have to get rid of the bias-related incident programs. You have to get rid of the bureaucracy that made this ideological purity test possible.
Exactly. All right. So let's go back to what you can say in relation to Intifada, because the way I see your argument, and it's one that I would share too, is that there's a real problem with anti-Semitism on campus. It's the same in the UK. It's been going on for a very long time, and Jewish students here get roughed up a lot, and they can't hold debates, and they certainly can't invite anyone from the Israeli state to come along and talk to them. There will always be protests, windows will be smashed, things will kick off. So there's a real problem in America and the UK for Jewish kids on campuses, I think. But at the same time, even as we acknowledge that and want to do something about it, at the same time, we, I'm being presumptive here, don't believe that the solution to that is to censor not only from the river to the sea, which there's a lot of debate about that, but even genuinely prejudicial ideas and genuinely prejudicial discussion, because history surely tells us that if you want to tackle racism, as I think we all do, well, certainly you and I do, you don't do that with the tools of censorship. There has to be something else.
My idiosyncratic argument for freedom of speech can be stated incredibly simply. It's always essential to know what people really think. Even just out of your own interest, it's important to know what people really think. And that's not even if they have horrible points of view. It's especially true if the people you're talking about have horrible points of view. Because when you look at a lot of the ideology on campus, there's kind of an assumption that everyone who disagrees with you might be a fascist or a totalitarian or a white supremacist or whatever. But those words mean actual things, you know, or at least they used to. And knowing that someone has like legit, eugenic ideas of racial superiority, that's incredibly important information to know. You're not safer from the world for knowing less about it. If people have horrifying points of view, it's important that you know, because sometimes actually you might assume that people have much worse points of view than they actually do. And it's important to actually understand that things aren't quite as bad as you thought. But here's the thing about what censoring does. There's something in First Amendment law talking about how censoring can lead speech to go underground and fester. I've never loved that way of putting it because it's not strong enough. And this is one of the things that's cool about like living in the sort of intersection of social science and First Amendment law is that group polarization is about as well established as a phenomena that ever existed. And that's basically if you go to a convention and you only talk to people you agree with, all of you, tend to leave more radicalized in the direction of the group. And all of us have had this experience before, you know, when we're in a politically homogenous thing on that one thing we agree with, we go in agreeing on that thing at a 2 and we leave agreeing on an 8. You know, we're all radicalized in the direction of the common belief. It's a very normal phenomenon. It makes even intuitive sense. But censorship doesn't actually change people's opinions. It encourages them to talk to people they already agree with. And that sets group polarization in the stratosphere. And in Canceling of the American Mind, we point to data that indicates kicking people off of Twitter and sending them to Gab. Well, guess what? Guess what that did? It made them more radicalized in the direction of the group. Completely predictable. So I think that there is a moderating power that happens from actually getting to talk across lines of difference. It's valuable to know what people really think. The idea that you're safer for not knowing what people really think is foolhardiness. And basically, all you're trying to avoid is the unpleasantness of knowing what people really think. And it's like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to get over that. I mean, you can feel the unpleasantness as much as you want, but knowing that the person you're going on a date with is or is not an actual anti-Semite is good information to have.
That is good information to have. I want to ask you about the right and the left and what is going on with them. In the book, The Canceling of the American Mind, you do a good breakdown of something that you and I have talked about before, which is the way in which freedom of speech went from being a leftist ideal, or certainly there were large, significant sections of the left that were very interested in freedom of speech and fought for it, in fact, to now being something that the left kind of poo-poos, and it's seen as something that conservatives defend. It's seen as something that the right defends. I've never been fully convinced by conservatives' commitment to freedom of speech. I think it has limitations, and we've seen that in various issues over the past few years. But we've particularly seen it since the 7th of October. And we have had this weird situation where in some cases it looks like it's the left that has returned to its defense of freedom of speech, particularly as it pertains to pro-Palestine speakers and pro-Palestine writers who are being censored. In Europe, it's got really bad, and I'm sure it's happening in America as well. And then you have the right, some of whom are cheering the attacks on students on campuses. And I don't just mean the arrest of students who are doing physically prohibited things. I mean the arrest of students who are just sitting around and holding up placards and so on. What have you made of that? There's a double standards on both sides, of course. But where do you see the left-right divide currently falling on the question of free speech?
Yeah, you know, it's one of these things where I'm worried for the future of freedom of speech in the United States and beyond, because it used to be that there was a contingent of the left that was unapologetically 150% freedom of speech. Like they really got it. Now, those people were always in tension with the Marcusians and like the people who actually thought, you know, if we just had enlightened people like me in charge, you know, we can censor whatever we want, who always thought it was monstrous totalitarians. But I grew up, you know, in a time where freedom of speech was largely considered something on the left. But to be fair, there was also a strong libertarian contingent on the right. And I always feel a little bad in some ways, like since I know libertarians and social conservatives, I feel like they're just fundamentally different people. They don't even like each other sometimes. Sometimes they like each other, but oftentimes they don't. And what I'm afraid that I'm seeing is that the sort of top-down utopian, they might think of it that way, I think of a totalitarian left is winning on the left. And the populist right is winning on the right. And there's no clear natural constituency for free speech other than the center. The center left and center right in the United States are actually pretty good. And that's tough because the center is generally going to have more moderate ideas of what should and shouldn't be protected. That's a worrisome situation. And FIRE is trying to actually find people all over the political spectrum to bring them into our free speech network. We now actually have about equal numbers of people from the right and the left as part of our million-person free speech army, which was a big part of the goal to bring them in. Because we know actually numbers-wise, there's still a big middle in the free speech that, you know, really means it when they say freedom of speech. It's liberals over 45 tend to be great on this stuff. Conservatives, you know, with exceptions, you know, for various topics, you know, we can definitely reach some of them that still have the libertarian mentality. And I don't apologize for saying that when people ask me, like, is it perfectly 50-50 in terms of the threats to free speech in the United States? That's never a thing. It's never, ever a case that one side isn't somewhat worse than the other. What I'm not as used to, though, is it used to be very much the right was decidedly worse than the left on free speech. I would say that in Canceling the American Mind and doing the research, although we take on the right a lot, and people like Donald Trump worry me a great deal, that when it comes to the left, particularly its dominance in higher ed, its dominance in the corporate world in the United States, they are a bigger part of the problem at the moment. And the fact that they actually have a much more rigid idea of what acceptable opinions are, it scares me. And I think this is all coming to a potentially very nasty head, you know, this fall and probably for 5-10 years to come. I've gotten this lecture from both people on the left and the right. This election is so serious and the stakes are so high for democracy itself. And it's time to pick a side. And who really cares about free speech when the stakes are this high? And I'm always like, no, you've gotten this completely backwards. When the stakes are this high, it's when the rules of the road get more, not less important. You know, there are people who hate our guts right now on an individual case here and there. But I have noticed that, you know, as time goes by, wanting that always consistent voice on these issues is something that they will crave at some point, and they'll be glad we're on that wall.
I did want to ask you about the form that censorship takes in the 21st century, in the era in which you and I are living. In the Canceling of the American Mind, you do a good breakdown of earlier versions of cancel culture, I guess one could say, you know, the McCarthyite witch hunts of the 1950s, the hunts against the communists, and then through to the clampdowns around the war on terror, the introduction of new laws, spying on people and restricting what people could say and how they could exchange ideas, and right through to today with the cancel culture situation on campuses in particular, but also in other areas of society too. And you will have heard this argument from the left, I presume. I certainly hear it all the time in the British context, which is the stuff you talk about on campus, that's not real censorship because it's not being done by the government. And I hear that from the left in Britain all the time. I'm sure you must hear it because the First Amendment largely only prevents government from acting against speech. And therefore, that does open the possibility to non-governmental actors introducing censorious situations. Is cancel culture different in some ways to those earlier episodes of censorship because it doesn't have that official edge all the time to it? It is often quite informal. It is sometimes the tyranny of opinion, as John Stuart Mill might have called it. But at the same time, if anything, that can make it even more insidious and sometimes a bit more difficult to challenge. So how do you see the form that censorship takes today?
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, there is tons of government censorship, particularly on campus, particularly when you have to remind people that state universities in the United States are obliged to uphold the First Amendment and private universities are obliged to uphold their promises. My alma mater, too, by the way, Stanford, a private college, is in the state of California, though, is actually bound by First Amendment standards under a local law. So, like, there's plenty of state censorship going on as part of cancel culture, and they can be hard to separate. But the part where you get this you know, ongoing head butting is whether or not classic cancel culture, in which, you know, someone cracks a joke on Twitter and then suddenly there's the appearance of a angry mob demanding that that reporter, for example, be fired. If that's just fine, that's just, you know, some speech is as good as any other. which is kind of like the Ken White argument, you know, which we talk a lot about, because he doesn't believe like free speech culture is a thing, which I find mystifying. It's kind of like, where did you think free speech came from? It didn't start as law. Laws are written by people. And I think that if you're calling for people involved in cancel mobs to be arrested, then yeah, actually you are saying that that should be unprotected speech. But I'm not familiar with anybody actually saying that. What you're saying is, yeah, they have the right to say that you need to fire this person, but it's illiberal. It's conformist. And what people have to remember, what John Stuart Mill was fighting against, he goes on at length in On Liberty about how actually there are some really good signs. There was like a press act of 1858. There were a number of happenings, you know, that actually made it look like things were actually pretty good for free speech from a legal standpoint in Britain. What was stifling was the Victorian certainty, conformity. It was a cultural conformity. So culture, you know, a stifling culture of conformity can be a terrible weapon against authenticity, against creativity, against against speech. And you have to actually be able to be willing to fight both. And one of the things that we come back to time and time again, and this was really striking to discover that Ricky, my co-author, didn't grow up with these things, is we used to have sayings that really embodied this stuff, idioms, you know, like everyone's entitled to their opinion, to each their own, not my cup of tea, you walk a mile in a man's shoes, all of these ideas that are basically kind of like, you know, it really isn't on you to decide what everybody else gets to think. Like, check yourself a little bit here. And we don't have that. Like, a lot of people graduating from colleges are kind of like, my way or the highway is more the idiom that they go with, because everybody, you know, who disagrees with them are fascists. So, I do think that if you think people demanding that people be fired for merely expressing their political opinion is not a threat to free speech and political expression, I think you're engaging in some mental gymnastics, and you'd immediately understand it if it was someone you agreed with.
No, those are some crazy mental gymnastics. On that same topic, I guess, I wanted to touch on the question of consequence culture, which is a new term that people use because no one wants to be called a canceller, you know, but people do talk about consequence culture. And you do touch on in the book the question of what the consequences for offensive speech might sometimes be. And you say that there are often consequences to speech, and I think everyone is aware of that. But you make the point that they need to be proportionate and they can't interfere with someone's fundamental rights. So talk a bit about what you think some of the consequences to speech should be, especially to speech that is really offensive or problematic, to use a word that is itself problematic. Talk a little bit about what you think are legitimate consequences to speech, given that you and I agree on what are some of the illegitimate consequences to speech, which we see all the time.
I don't think younger people actually get this. We saw a big spike in attempts to get professors fired coming from students around 2017. And it takes a lot of chutzpah for students to reach a point where they're actually signing, you know, change.org petitions to get their professors fired or otherwise sanctioned or punished for their speech or research or teaching. And that's historically unusual. I think that the younger people today, it's kind of like, oh, well, this is just what the protests looked like in the 60s. Like, no, they didn't. They were not saying this professor needs to be fired for their opinion. That was a non-starter in many cases. Like, sometimes you'd have like a eugenicist, you know, professor, but it would have to be a pretty extreme case before you'd see anything like that. What was the way that students let their disdain be known? You know, they're going to now seem pretty quaint. Write an op-ed. Write an article, you know, protest outside the class. Like, there are tons of ways to let your disdain be known without going that extra step to trying to get someone fired. Now, and that's the thing that I find so maddening about the idea of consequence culture, is that if you mean the consequence is someone's not going to like you, then sure, that's the risk of living in a free society, that someone's going to hate your guts for your opinion. It comes with the territory. But that's not what they mean. A lot of times what they mean is, well, sure, I mean, like, the consequence here is that you'll never work again. And it's kind of like, okay, so in your world, it's not at all problematic that someone can state their honestly held political opinion. So basically, they can have a political opinion, they just can't say it and work again. And that's a consequence that has no, what, downstream negative effects for a free and pluralistic society. That's insane. That's a rationalization to get to exactly where you want. And these very same people, usually when they see, you know, someone from the right getting professors canceled, which does happen quite often, they suddenly get it. They suddenly get like the idea, kind of like, well, you know, that's a problem. So, yeah, I think that when it comes to like what kind of consequences having people dislike you, having people go hard after your methodology, protesting your class, like that's all completely within bounds. But when you're actually saying that this person needs to be fired for their opinion, that's illiberal.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show. Okay, Greg, just a couple more quick questions. You've written a lot with Jonathan Haidt previously and also about your own experiences in relation to the mental health arena, about the argument that everyone will have heard and everyone will be familiar with, and many, many people will have read you and Jonathan's critique of it, which is this notion that students are hyperfragile or that their hyperfragility is a normal part of their life. I'm sure some students are hyperfragile, having been conditioned to be so. And that this is a natural part of being a young person. And the only way in which they can be protected from the slings and arrows of everyday life is in the safe space with the wall of censorship, the firewall of censorship to protect their kind of fragile mental condition from anything that might offend it or hurt it. Trigger warnings on books, for example, students being allowed to duck out of controversial discussions, all those kinds of issues that people will be familiar with. How do you think that side of the discussion is going? I mean, you and Jonathan had a lot of cut through for sure. I mean, hugely important people were reading and talking about your book. And there was a moment when I thought this could well be the starting point of a rehabilitation of resilience, a rehabilitation of robustness, or certainly a recognition of the virtue of those things. How do you think it stands now in terms of the idea of hyperfragility and protecting students from everyday debate and everyday life?
I think our book has been read by more people than I could ever have imagined. You know, it's probably going to hit like a million copies at some point. Like the response has been really powerful. And I still feel like the way it's reflected back to me is fundamentally misunderstanding the entire point of the book because people are doubling down on therapy and they're doubling down on therapeutic culture. And they're saying, oh, you know, Lukianoff and Haidt are saying is that there's a mental health crisis. And it's kind of like, yeah. And what we're saying is causing that is what is effectively, oftentimes by example, whispering into young people's ears, you are fragile, which human beings aren't naturally fragile for the most part. That you'll be permanently harmed by words, not necessarily. If you create the expectation that you'll be harmed by words, then it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But there's a reason why we said sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Obviously, it didn't mean that names didn't hurt, but it meant here's a way to insulate yourself from it, to rise above it. Like that was a great tactic. You know, got a lot of kids, including myself, like through some tough times. You know, and also that life is a battle between good people and evil people, which we call the third great untruth. And we're whispering these things into these otherwise, you know, potentially very competent, very together kids. And it's devastating to their mental health because once you actually believe you're fragile, There's nowhere to hide. You just get deeper and deeper inside of yourself. The way you actually do someone a favor is by actually, you know, taking them by the shoulder and being kind of like, you know what? You're resilient. You can handle this. Things will be difficult, but they'll get easier each time you challenge yourself. All of this normal parental human advice about how to thrive in the world as it actually is, we thought that reversing it somehow would make students happier. And of course, it's making them miserable because they're sadder around normal interactions. And here's the thing that actually pushes me into outright angry about this. I think a lot of these tactics were used to guilt and shame students into being better political proxies, you know, for the people telling them these things. That essentially, if you feel tremendous guilt and shame about global warming, you'll feel the motivation to go fix it. And this is messed up because it's basically telling someone to feel tremendous guilt and shame, and that's devastating to their mental health, and that's cruel by itself. It's also wrongheaded. There is something called depressive realism, but there's no such thing as anxious realism. People tend to see the world less accurately when they're scared, and they're certainly not effective activists when they're depressed. So I think that we've created this situation based on some not very well thought through assumptions that are devastating on every level to everything from mental health to actually getting the change in the world that you want. It's counterproductive and cruel.
That's very well put. And I've recently had Jonathan Haidt and Abigail Schreier on the podcast, and both of them have made a great case for, you know, robustness and not allowing therapy culture to screw people up any more than it already has. Okay, Greg, my last question for you, I guess, is a bit of a broad one. I sometimes feel frustrated in relation to the free speech discussion because I often feel like I'm troubleshooting terrible problems that are emerging on campuses or in public discussion. And I'm saying, no, let's please, let's have a bit more freedom of speech. Or I'm saying to younger people, listen, it will be okay. You won't be particularly wounded if you hear this idea you disagree with. Don't worry, you'll be fine. And it seems that the space to stand up and say, actually, freedom of speech is the best idea mankind ever came up with, is shrinking all the time. You know, the ability just to really stand on a soapbox and say, listen, this is the most important ideal and the best ideal in a civilized society. That I sometimes find that frustrating. And I think about the American Civil Liberties Union, which used to do that kind of thing all the time. And you'd listen to them and think, wow, freedom of speech is super cool. They do less of that these days. Lots of groups do less of it. You guys, of course, still do it. But it's frustrating, isn't it, sometimes, that I guess you feel like you're firefighting all the time, these various crises that are blowing up, and the space in which to really sing the praises of this liberty are not necessarily there as much as they might have been in the past.
Yeah, no. I call these problems of comfort in freedom from speech, and then problems of progress in coddling the American mind, that there's a certain category of things that will get worse precisely because other things are getting better. Now, a more comfortable society in which your physical needs are met, in which you experience less physical pain, where you can be around people you agree with and share your values, all of that sounds lovely. It sounds like Ronald Engelhardt's idea of progress going back to the 1970s and his post-materialist society idea. But it's going to come with some downsides. And one of them is that people who are more used to comfort, more used to being in communities that reflect their values, are going to be less comfortable with the unpleasantness of free speech done correctly. I think that there's at least partially a natural evolution here, but there's also a very intentional platform here. There's a very intentional move, particularly by people in academia, that wanted to turn people on freedom of speech because, like, why should you believe in freedom of speech when our philosopher kings are in charge? We'll know what to censor, and we'll be able to control the world and control the realm of thought in a way that would make Plato blush. Fighting one of those things, the natural causes of it, means that we have to be unapologetically pro-resilience and actually have things that challenge kids and actually make them uncomfortable, that shying from discomfort is never going to work. But the other one is take on the ideologues who have been making this argument for a really long time and actually believing that their philosopher kings will be the ones in charge. Because even if they are, it's still evil. It's still totalitarianism. So I think that, it's up to us to fight for free speech. It's back to being kind of a lonely job like it had been for most of human history. We were very lucky for that both of us grew up at a time when free speech was probably at its high watermark. And we're back to something more like situation normal, where we're the weirdos pointing this stuff out. But I think the best reason to have some faith in freedom of speech is that it works really well. Knowing what people really think, being able to talk across lines of difference, being able to take seriously the likelihood you might be wrong, these are all huge advantages, not just for groups and organizations, but even for individuals. So the power of freedom of speech is hard to deny when people see it in action. I think more and more people are going to be seeing how well it works in a sea of conformity.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.